Blog Talk Radio.
Happy Thursday, everyone. This is Melissa Bilardi, your host on Help for HD. We are recording live and podcasting all about help for Huntington's disease. The goal every week is to introduce incredible special guests to educate and inspire you. We now have 5,500 listeners, so thank you all for your support and interest in Help for HD programming. A special thanks to Lundbeck, Inc. for bringing us Xenazine, the first FDA-approved drug for chorea associated with Huntington's disease, and for supporting Help for HD. Without all of you, we would not have a show. During our live programs, please call into the show to ask questions on two phone lines, 310-982-4227. And our toll-free is 877-497-4103. When you call in, press 1, and I will cue you into the show. Please tell all your friends and family about the show and click follow on our show page to get email reminders of upcoming episodes. And don't forget, this is a special midweek episode that will be aired again next Thursday at 3:30 p.m. PST, that's California time. Our incredible special guest today is Dr. John LaPuma. He is a practicing internist, culinary school grad, and TV personality on What's Cooking with Chef MD. And Lifetime's Health Corner, What Do I Eat for This? Or for That, excuse me. His PBS special, Eat and Cook Healthy with Dr. John LaPuma, premiered in March and will be shown nationwide on PBS in June. So check your local listings. Dr. LaPuma is here to teach us how to eat our way to optimal health. Find Dr. LaPuma at www.drjohnlapuma.com and on Facebook, Dr. John LaPuma. Welcome to the show today, Dr. LaPuma. How are you?
I'm great, Melissa. So nice to be with you.
Thank you so much. Well, tell us a little about your background.
I am an internist. I'm a board-certified internist. I practice in Santa Barbara, California, where my focus is primarily on nutrition. I help people with nutritional solutions to their medical problems, especially obesity and overweight. And I'm also a trained chef. I went to cooking school after I went to medical school because I wanted to know how to give my patients a diet that tasted good and they would actually follow. And I also wanted to keep weight off that I had lost. And so I think of myself primarily as a teacher. I love to teach both cooking and medicine. And it's just really fun for me to get questions from people and find out both what they're really good at and what they really care about.
Now, you're thinking about doing a radio blog yourself, which would be really great.
I've loved the experience I've had with PBS. You mentioned the special that premiered in March and will be nationwide in June for a couple of weeks, and then again in September and later in the year, and I'm told into 2012. But I've never hosted radio, so I hope to learn from you, Melissa, and figure out how to do it.
It's quite fun. It's quite fun and exhilarating, a little nerve-wracking at the beginning, but you get used to it, and it's really fun. So what brought you to the concept of holistic eating and cooking?
I have always thought that there were other than pharmacologic approaches to medical problems, particularly lifestyle-related problems. And because I've always looked for larger solutions, not simply medication. I don't have anything against medication. I prescribe both medications and recipes. I write recipes on prescription slips as well as medications. But I have felt that because people live primarily outside of the doctor's office, that there must be other ways of approaching common clinical problems that do not include simply what most physicians are taught in medical school about medications and devices. So my interest has always been in looking for other complementary ways to improve health in difficult conditions as well as relatively straightforward ones.
Well, you have quite a video blog on your website that is just incredible. I've enjoyed watching quite a few of them, for different types of conditions and certain issues that people have. And I would suggest that everyone who's listening, anyone who is interested in watching the recipes and advice on eating properly for certain conditions is just an amazing, incredible work, and I really appreciate seeing that. It's different when it comes from a person talking than just reading. But you have written books and you've contributed with other writings. And so tell us about your book with Rebecca Powell Marks, the Chef MD Big Book of Culinary Medicine.
Chef MD's Big Book of Culinary Medicine is my most recent book. And in it, I cover 40 different conditions from constipation and heart disease to kidney stones and irritable bowel syndrome, and give people kind of a blending of the art of cooking with the science of medicine to create what I think are restaurant quality recipes that help prevent disease as well as, in some cases, actually treat disease, and in occasionally as well or even better than medication. And the easy way to think about this is that you have a lot more control than you think. If you, for example, add avocado to a spinach salad, you actually absorb 7 times the lutein, the eye-protecting antioxidant, in that spinach salad than you do with no avocado. So that's a reason to use a full-fat dressing instead of a low-fat dressing. If you sprinkle black pepper on a curry, you absorb the curcumin, which is the anti-inflammatory chemical in turmeric, which is what makes all curries yellow. But if you don't have any black pepper on your curry, you don't absorb that curcumin, and curcumin reduces Alzheimer's risk and stabilizes ulcerative colitis and acts as an anti-inflammatory for arthritis pain. If you marinate meats, even a dunk in a marinade will reduce by 77% the heterocyclic amines, which are the bad chemicals that form at high heat or grilling, when grilling meats, chicken or fish or beef or whatever. And if you add rosemary to that marinade, the extra protective effect of rosemary reduces HCA formation, which are carcinogenic, even further. And that's why you don't want those grill marks that are charred on the outside of your meat, even though they may taste good. They actually promote intestinal cancer and other dysplasias. Simple things like this, and you know, if you cook pasta al dente instead of till mushy, you actually lower its glycemic load. It is absorbed into your system more slowly and gently, so you don't get a big sugar spike and a big insulin spike and feel like tearing the door off the refrigerator a few hours later. These kinds of little bite-sized bits, I think, help people learn that blending the art of cooking with the science of medicine is a lot easier than you think, and that they don't have to be perfect in order to do it. So in this book, I actually tell you what I tell my own patients here in Santa Barbara, and I give an 8-week plan so that people who need structure and like structure can try it and take a quiz at the beginning and at the end. So if they're having symptoms of arthritis, or if they're having symptoms of insomnia, or they're having high cholesterol, they can implement the program, and which covers fitness as well as diet and stress management, and then at the end take the quiz again and see on an objective empiric basis what sort of progress they've made.
So it's more like a gastro science what you're doing.
You know, I see lots of patients who bring in 20 supplements into the office, and I say, well, why are you taking this one? And a patient may often say, well, I thought it was good for me, or I hoped that it would help. But unless you have a reason to start that's concrete and a way to measure whether it's helpful, you don't know whether to continue it or discontinue it, and so you never really get a fair shake at whether it can help you. I like people to be able to become measurably healthier with what they eat and how they exercise and have a good time doing it.
Right. Now, you've also contributed recipes to Dr. Oz and Rosen's You, the Owner's Manual. And when did that happen? When did you work with that information?
My friend and colleague, Mike Roizen, who's now head of the Wellness Institute at the Cleveland Clinic and one of the UDocs, and I wrote The Real Age Diet and Cooking the Real Age Way. Mike started realage.com, which is still a wonderful and going concern. 27 million people have taken Real Age. the real age test to figure out their body's biological age as they've chosen to take care of it versus their birthday age.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a fun, easy, still free thing to do. And then Mike and I contributed the recipes that I created for Real Age to you, the owner's manual, which Dr. Oz was and Dr. Royson wanted to have. And those recipes are still ones I'm proud of and are relatively easy to make. Most of them are 30 minutes or less. The ChefMD recipes that I recently did are all 30 minutes or less and 10 ingredients or less and simple cooking techniques. The one in You, the Owner's Manual, the ones in, are a little more complex, and their flavor profiles are a little more aggressive because it was a chancy time where I could take some risks and introduce people to really bold flavors, which I love.
Mm-hmm.
And so I contribute to Dr. Oz's ShareCare.com, which is also a wonderful format for people answering questions from experts, and do so on my Facebook page as well. It's such an exciting time, Melissa, for people who want to take control of their clinical conditions and become both self-measurers and self-managers. And in the Huntington's community, as you well know, many people are actually ahead of their doctors in many ways about how they can, what makes their condition better and what makes it worse.
Mm-hmm.
I really think people are the experts on their own bodies if they learn to pay attention, if they learn to how their body feels when they do X, when they eat this or they don't eat that, or when they manage stress in a particular way or they don't.
Right. We're going
to
talk about a little bit about that, too, because, you know, for us caregivers, stress is a huge factor and lack of sleep is another huge factor. And the two in tandem are just really deadly combinations. So, you know, we need to kind of step up and make a little effort and learn about what we can do to take better care of ourselves because, I mean, let's face it, our HDRs are depending on us. So we can't go down. We have to stay up all the time and be healthy as possible. So I'm really thrilled to have you on the show. So you'll give me more inspiration to take better care of myself because, I mean, honestly, I've not been doing a very good job of it. So this is very good for me, too. But you also have a thriving practice in internal medicine, and you're practicing in Santa Barbara. Is that correct?
I do, although my practice is not so much in general internal medicine anymore. I was privileged to do that for a number of years in Chicago. But here it's primarily on nutrition and weight management and often cholesterol control because I get to spend much more time with people this way and do it one-on-one. And I have wonderful patients. They're really tremendously interesting, accomplished people who can't get control of their weight. Or can't get control of their cholesterol, or can't get control of their blood pressure, and want to look at lifestyle ways of controlling it so maybe they can reduce their dependence on medication or get off it altogether. The caregiving role is one that we spend a lot of time on Health Corner. Health Corner is a television show that I was privileged to host ChefMD on for 4 years on Lifetime, and it's hosted by Lisa Gibbons and then Joan London, both of whom with whom I worked, and are wonderful people.
Mm-hmm.
And they, Lisa especially, has a caregiver's foundation that focuses, as you probably know, on people with dementia. And engaging secondary caregivers in available interventions and services, which are usually targeted to the primary giver, I think, is one of the things that she's focused on. And that's because those interventions can reduce the burden of primary caregivers like yourself and delay institutionalization of the HD or the demented person.
Mm-hmm.
And so
I didn't know about that. Yeah, I'm going to check into that.
Lisa's Foundation is what it's called. Lisa is spelled LEEZA, and it's centered in Florida, although I think she has licensed or franchised it to other locations. It's very hard to to manage stress efficiently, and I don't think either primary or secondary caregivers do it well. But probably the emotional and cognitive strategies, like drawing on your own personal or religious beliefs, the research shows, are actually more effective for primary caregivers than secondary ones. Everybody benefits equally, I think, from drawing on their own expertise and experience and finding solutions to problems. I actually gave a 60-minute talk to financial advisors in Atlanta and in Las Vegas this spring on stress management. And it was really fun. They're great people. This is for Lincoln Financial Group, and it was a national conference for 400 people in each audience. And the research there shows that financial advisors reduce stress very well, and they're kind of like physicians for people who need help in managing their money and their investments and their lifestyle. They have an actual holistic role. Those people reduce stress best when they become more efficient at their jobs.
That's true.
Unbelievable to me. You know, it's not yoga and relaxation and exercise, although those things are helpful. It's not just B vitamins to reduce stress and eating fewer processed foods, although there's data on both of those, for both of those actions to reduce stress. What helped them the most was to become more efficient, to use their energy in well. And for them, it was things like, and your caregivers may want to use the same strategies, not saying, you know, I can meet you anytime next week. Just name your time.
Mm-hmm.
Instead of that, because your time is at a premium, you say, I have open 10:15 on Thursday and 8 o'clock on Friday. I also have 3:15 on Friday. Which one would be best for you?
Mm-hmm. So time management is huge, right?
You take control of your schedule, like right. Taking control of your diet.
Okay, I need to learn both of those things.
Well, that hint actually works. That what I just meant. That's how I do my appointments.
Yeah.
Anybody listening and on any podcast, that's how I do my appointments. Someone says, I'd love to I had somebody yesterday call me from a startup who wants some help with a quantification of personal health. He said, I'd love to have 30 minutes of your time. I wrote him back and said, you can have Thursday at 10:15. Does that work?
Yep.
Because I'm actually busy, you know. I have other appointments. I have patients to take care of. I have books to write. So it's not selfish. They're asking for 30 minutes of your time, or you need to make a connection. Why not make it so that it works in your schedule?
It's just time. It's good time management.
And good time management gives you more control. It gives you a feeling that the world isn't slipping away from you. It allows you to respond instead of react. One of the things I taught these financial advisors was to instead of, you know, wanting to slap who's ever across the desk or collapse into tears, You make yourself pause by some kind of mantra. For me, that's usually thank you,
that's nice.
Because it gives me a moment. So if something very stressful happens, my response is something, it could be to myself, but it's sometimes to another person. Thank you. And I take a breath.
Mm-hmm.
And that gives me just enough time to not react, say something I'm going to regret.
That helps
and
the blood pressure too, right?
It does.
Yeah.
So pause, respond, not react.
Oh, very good. With that in mind, let me just break in here for a second. We're already 15 minutes into the show, actually. More than 15 minutes, but you are listening to Help for HD. This is Melissa, your host, and our incredible special guest today is Dr. John LaPuma. Our call-in numbers for the live segment are 310-982-4227 and 877-497-4103. We are recording live, but you may listen again right after the end of the show, and we will be airing this episode again on Thursday, April 28th at 3:30 p.m. PST. That's California time. And everyone listening, please don't hesitate to call in with questions. Dr. Lipum, I'm sure, is very looking forward to speaking to you. So time management is huge, I know, and especially when you're trying to function on low amount of sleep. So I think the main thing is, for me, is if I can get more sleep, I might be able to function a little bit better. What is your take on the sleep issue?
Well, I think sleep deprivation has been directly linked to obesity. People who sleep less weigh more. It is really that direct. And sleep deprivation, I think, also doesn't allow you to use all of the faculties that you have. It doesn't allow you to, for example, enjoy your food as much. It doesn't allow you to be as alert as you want to be. So one of the things that I teach my patients here in Santa Barbara is the 4-7-8 belly breath for going to sleep when they can't fall asleep. And that 4-7-8 belly breath is inhaling for 4 through your nose, holding for 7, and then exhaling for 8, pooching out your belly as you exhale. You exhale through your mouth. So then you inhale through your nose for 4 counts, hold for 7 counts, and exhale through your mouth for 8 counts, pooching out your belly as you do. This is actually the reverse of your reactive, normal, instinctual inhalation to exhalation ratio.
Oh,
but it allows you to, it calms your pulse rate. It gives you something other to focus on than what you've been thinking about, which is often why you can't go to sleep. And it allows your breath, which of course is portable and always with you, to center your energy and concentrate, and is quite effective both in insomnia, which you ought to repeat 4 times and then rest for a couple minutes and repeat it again 4 times, and also for other stress-related problems like road rage. People who have road rage, I asked us to try 4-7-8, and of course here in Southern California we have lots of traffic.
Lots of road rage.
And really, it's a road rage recipe. Now, the insomnia recipes, and people are at increased risk, of course, if they're a smoker or stressed or have a loud or light sleeping environment or have a condition like sleep apnea. And I do cover 40 different conditions in the book with 50 recipes. And insomnia is one of those conditions. And people know that foods that contain tryptophan, like turkey at Thanksgiving, actually metabolize into melatonin, which is a hormone that regulates sleep cycles.
Okay.
So it's not just turkey, though, that has tryptophan. It's chicken and fish and cottage cheese and bananas and eggs and nuts and avocados and dairy products and legumes. And curiously enough, the whole cookies and milk thing, the carbohydrates with high glycemic index eaten 4 hours before bedtime, actually help you get to sleep faster.
Wow.
Not if you eat them right before bedtime. It actually doesn't work if you eat them an hour or 2 hours before bedtime. But the study was done with high glycemic index carbs that are absorbed very rapidly. Mm-hmm. And people who eat a high glycemic index meal 4 hours before bedtime get to sleep in an average of 9 minutes, as opposed to people who eat a meal that isn't that high glycemic index. So that's exactly the opposite advice of what we usually give. We want people to have less highly available carb. But if you're having trouble getting to sleep, then having a high glycemic index meal for dinner actually may work.
Wow. Good advice. Tell us about Chef Clinic.
Chef Clinic is our consulting group that also encompasses the medical practice that allows people to learn cooking and healthy eating and fitness skills. It's an acronym, that's the chef part of it,
okay,
as a way of controlling overweight, obesity, and many of the conditions that come with it, heart disease and stroke, premature wrinkling, premature memory loss, erectile dysfunction. All those, by the way, are the same artery resting process. They all are a blood flow process. And as you improve your ability to create the good skills that you need and use the skills, you both prevent resting in your arteries and increase blood flow to those areas and can work on preventing heart disease and stroke and premature memory loss, premature wrinkling.
You said resting?
Resting, R-U-S-T-I-N-G. Well, it's actually an easy way to understand the atherosclerotic process that occurs inside of the arteries, which become ragged and nicked by the LDL or lousy cholesterol that travels down the artery and nicks the wall and helps to have deposits build up, which is how blockages begin to occur in your arteries and eventually, sadly for some people, cause arterial blockage and even rupture. That blockage is what occurs in heart attack and in stroke. But, you know, even mild forms of those conditions of heart disease and of brain disease can make you feel run down. And what I try to do in the ChefMD Culinary Medicine book is to give people ways to lose pounds, not flavor, to begin to eat themselves healthy, because the missing component in good-for-you food really is flavor. And no matter what you did yesterday, and you have another chance. I mean, you get a do-over. You can really replace bad habit.
Right.
Yeah. You can replace bad habit.
Yeah. So tell us about your television series. It's exciting.
I was privileged to do ChefMD on Health Corner with Lifetime TV for 4 years, and now I'm doing this terrific Eat and Cook Healthy with Dr. John LaPuma for PBS. And I am working on another project that looks like it may result in a second PBS special. I can't say very much about it yet, but I hope that it will do so, because I think TV is really the best way to teach. It really is about making things fun and easy and illustrate them.
The videos I've seen are very fun. I hope everyone can go look at your videos, and the ones that were on PBS, or the early ones, were just very entertaining. You know, we're almost getting ready to wrap up the 30 minutes. Now, are you available to maybe continue talking, or can we reschedule maybe part two?
I have all the time in the world for you, Melissa.
Wonderful. So we can keep talking after the live portion goes off the air, and we'll go ahead and do that. We have, I think, 1 minute left on the live portion, so I'll conclude the live portion of the show today with Dr. John LaPuma. And you can find Dr. LaPuma at www.drjohnlapuma.com and on Facebook, Dr. John LaPuma. And my email address is helpforhd@yahoo.com. And, John, where can people find your books?
They can find them on Amazon, on Barnes & Noble, in bookstores, wherever books are sold. If they don't have it, email them and ask them for it, because that's how they'll get it. But they've been selling pretty well recently and should be available online everywhere.
Great. So everyone, don't forget to tell your friends and family that we will be re-airing the show on Thursday, April 28th at 3:30 p.m. PST. And then on Monday, April 25th, we have another incredible special guest, Will Huff from Grassroots Research and Collective, here to talk about CB2 cannabinoid receptors and the neuroprotective properties of cannabinoid medicine. Good night to everyone. Good day to everyone. We'll talk to you soon. And thanks for tuning in to Help for HD. Other announcements. May 2nd, Jane Kogan, HDSA Advocacy and HD Parity Act. May 9th, Dr. Ira Schulson, Huntington's Disease Study Group, or Huntington's Study Group. He's the founder and chairman. May 16th and the 23rd, I'm looking for JHD programming about juvenile Huntington's disease. June 6th, July 5th, and August 8th, we have a CREST-E series. This is the creatine clinical study, and that will be June 6th, July 5th, and August 8th. New group on Facebook, Help for HD, Help HSG Awareness. Please ask to join. We need we need input from our HDRs. And we'll talk to you soon, everyone. Thanks for tuning in. And Dr. John LaPuma, we can go ahead and keep talking. That went fast, didn't it?
It did. So, thanks so much for...
Yes. Go ahead. I'm sorry.
Well, thanks so much for having me. It's fun to talk with you.
Thank you so much. Well, let's talk a little bit more about the Santa Barbara Institute for Medical Nutrition. That sounds very interesting to me.
It's been a lot of fun to do. It harbors my medical practice, and it allows me to consult with people, not just in the medical practice, but outside of it. So it's located downtown near the Cottage Hospital, and I'm there every week and as often as I can be.
And so what do you do there? Your coach?
I coach. I see patients. I construct diet plans for people. I allow people to try to identify what it is that they want to control with what they eat. And then I do sort of personalized research to figure out what the state of the art is in their particular condition. And that's just a marvelous kind of exercise for me and often for them, because there are many different studies sort of hidden in the medical literature, especially, but sometimes in the food chemistry literature and in the agricultural literature, which sometimes give a clue to their condition that may not be at the top of their own physician's list because doctors are so busy and we really don't have time to keep up on all different aspects of medicine, really just our own. And since nutrition really is mine, that's where I go to do that research. And it's a really good challenge. It's not, and it's always personalized. Everybody really has a different specific profile and need. So when I do those sorts of consultations, they are really by special appointment, but that's why the Institute's set up that way.
Are there specific categories that people kind of fall into, are you finding? Or is everyone just completely different from another?
In weight management, yes, there are certainly categories for people. Bob Kushner at Northwestern has identified a personality characteristic for obesity, especially in 21 different categories, and has a personality profile test so you can see whether you're a people pleaser or one of or 20 other categories. But and we've done the same with a questionnaire that we have online that's free that some medical practices are now licensing, which is one that I created to help me understand people's eating habits and their motivations. And it's available under our clinic tab on my drjohnlapuma.com website. And the categories that people tend to focus on, I found, divide pretty evenly into men and women. Seems to me that that's the biggest difference. Those are the two large categories. Instead of personality, I think gender is a really big divide. And within that, men especially need very different things than women do when they want to lose weight.
Mm-hmm. Is it kind of driven by hormones, maybe?
It might be. I don't know why. It's probably... both the biggest difference in the world between men and women and the biggest riddle. I don't know why people are as men and women are so different in their needs, but I do know that men, for example, respond much better to direction than women do. Like,
interesting.
These eat two vegetables with a green and a yellow for lunch. Mm-hmm. And let me know how that works. Women generally need to process more and know the reasons behind things and fit it in for other people as well as themselves. Mm-hmm. So it's a curious and really interesting, quite motivating set of demands and queries, and I really hope to learn more about this difference, because there really isn't yet a good diet book for men. And what are your thoughts about that? Do you think there's a difference in between how men
totally
diet?
I think metabolism is one, and I think hormones maybe. Now, you know, I have someone in my family that is hormones aren't normal. So, you know, there's another set of rules, because you know, we're dealing with someone that doesn't have the normal hormonal levels, and so there's a different body type, you know. So maybe it's body type, maybe it's hormones, maybe it's gender, maybe it's all of the above. Who knows? I really don't. But I'm kind of curious. I'd like to learn more myself. I think I would love to see you do a blog talk radio series on all of this interesting stuff. I think it could be very helpful to a lot of people. And now the Chef MD is for your recipes and your videos and your Facebook connection. Is that correct?
The Chef MD is for healthy recipes primarily, and it does show off the Lifetime videos, which we've also uploaded to YouTube. And it's a brand that I want to continue to develop and leverage, but I'm kind of separately from that, I'm trying to build my own personal identity and with the very many other sorts of things that I'm interested in, including, as we've just talked about, the men and women's differences and gender differences in weight management. I mean, Chef MD sort of does everything but weight management from a health condition standpoint, and it's been a terrific ride. And I respond to questions on its Facebook page and often post healthy recipes these days.
Mm-hmm. That's great. And you have a fan page there.
Yes, we have a fan page for it, and then I have my own fan page, which you know about, and I'm working on developing.
Great. Now, you are also a winemaker, and that's when I first met you at a winery. So tell us about your winemaking, and why is wine good for us?
I love winemaking, and I love wine. Wine is good for us in many ways, and of course I'm not talking about people who are addicted or have a predilection for addiction or have liver damage or have reasons that are medical not to drink wine. But if you can drink wine, I think it does offer a lot of benefits. And on both of these topics, both wine and wine pairing, as well as stress management, which we talked about online on Blog Talk Radio, I created PBS DVDs that are over 30 minutes long each, on my views on wine and wine pairing and its health effects, and also my suggested tips for stress and stress management. And they're available for a donation to PBS. I don't sell them, but PBS does, as it were.
PBS, or?
Yes, we would create a link to either shoppbs.org, which I think they're not quite up yet, or your favorite PBS station. Many PBS stations, including mine here in Southern California, PBS SoCal or KOCE, have them listed online, and there's a link on my website to that PBS donation DVD set. But you can donate to it or to your own PBS station and get that as a thank you gift. And I mention it because I recently did think a lot and research about wine and its health effects.
Mm-hmm.
It's not just the alcohol in it, which raises your HDL or healthy cholesterol and helps to defend your body against the LDL or lousy cholesterol, but it's also the resveratrol and tannins and anthocyanins and all the other chemicals, and there are over 600 of them, in wine, especially red wine, that help to help your body reduce inflammation and reduce oxidation. My interest in winemaking isn't, though, just in the health benefits, although I was happy to learn about them. It's really more because it's a wonderful physical thing to do. It taxes and challenges me in ways that cognitive work doesn't. It's a lot of like cooking in that you can, if you're a good cook, you can be a good winemaker. You want to blend flavors. You want to be a good observer. You want to give many processes time instead of forcing them to happen. It teaches you patience. It teaches you appreciation for sensuality. It's often communal and involves friends. I have a bottling party every couple of years where I have 50 people over to bottle and pretty soon 3 barrels of wine. So I love a lot of things about winemaking. I'm going to a winemaking conference here in Santa Barbara later in May and look forward to meeting other home winemakers.
That's wonderful. So not only are you an amazing internist and culinary artist, but you're also a vinery artist. That's amazing. Okay, let's talk about something else. I noticed that you have a gluten-free quiz, and that's something that you designed. Is that correct?
That's right.
Tell us about that, because I'm really interested in that.
Gluten-free quiz and glutenfreequiz.com, I created about 3 years ago now, possibly a little longer, maybe 4 years ago. 4 years ago, that's right. And about tens of thousands of people have taken the quiz. In fact, it may be hundreds by now. I haven't looked at the data recently. But it was based on a patient that I saw who was referred to me because she had bloating and indigestion, and she was in her middle, late 50s and wasn't feeling well. And her internist thought that it could be something nutritional, and so did she. So I saw her in my office as a consultation. And as I went through it, she had a number of problems that I thought could be related to gluten. She had osteoporosis. She had been infertile as a younger woman. She had a brother with type 1 diabetes, if I recall, although she herself didn't have diabetes. And so I asked her to eliminate a number of foods along a food elimination approach and then added them back one by one. And it became clear over time that foods that were gluten-containing were the problem. And she ultimately turned out to have celiac disease, which, as you know, is an autoimmune reaction against gluten, where your body sees the protein gluten, which is the principal protein in protein complex in wheat and rye and also in oats and in barley, as an allergen, as an immunogen, as something that it attacks. It's not an allergy. It's an immunologic disease, and about one out of 133 Americans have it. But until recently, it wasn't identified as a common adult disease. It was thought of as more of a kid's disease.
Wow.
But that's not true. And now, over the last 4 years or so, gluten-free eating has become almost faddish in some ways. It is a healthy way to eat for many people because if you are paying attention to gluten, you often need to, although this is a little less true than it was 4 years ago, be able to cook yourself. You have to read ingredients well.
There's a lot more products available for gluten-free now, breads and such.
That's right. You can buy gluten-free donuts and gluten-free potato chips, and which were often tinged with gluten. But people who have celiac disease, who are actually have that autoimmune disease or are highly gluten sensitive, which is not the same thing, often don't go for those products because they are kind of what they got them into trouble to begin with.
Mm-hmm.
That is the fast, highly processed foods. And our gluten-free quiz gives you a easy, non-invasive way to answer about 11 questions and give you a highly sensitive, moderately specific way of identifying whether you should be tested for celiac disease, which is both a blood test, and if the blood test is positive, in many cases, an intestinal biopsy. And although that may seem harsh or like a lot to do, food is the cure in celiac disease. If you have a gluten immune problem, then avoiding gluten cures it. And in my patient, who I mentioned, her osteoporosis improved. She actually lost weight. She wasn't terribly heavy to begin with, and most celiac patients are not. But it changed her whole life. She became much more animated.
So are you finding more people are sensitive to gluten than you thought?
You know, it's been shown that the celiac disease in this country has quadrupled in the last 50 years. And it's not because of an increased interest in diagnosis. They've gone back and looked at blood samples that were 50 years old and compared them to blood samples currently. And no one quite knows why. Gluten sensitivity is different than celiac disease. While gluten sensitivity is more of an immune, in the allergen sphere, celiac disease or gluten enteropathy is an immune disease, as I've said. But there are people who are sensitive to gluten who have bloating and fatigue and some of the same symptoms of celiac disease without the actual often problematic medical problems that result and feel better if they eat less gluten. For those people, I like to have a clinical trial. I mean, I like to be really systematic about whether or not. You can't just kind of dabble and say, well, I'm not going to eat spaghetti today and I'll see if I feel better tomorrow. You might, but it might have nothing to do with gluten. So if you do decide that you're gluten sensitive or you want to know, the best way to do it is to go to a physician or a dietitian and be systematic about which foods have gluten and which ones don't. And celiac.com and celiac.org are two good sites which have references and links to sites where you can learn more.
But if we're curious and we kind of want to know in private, we can go to the gluten-free quiz and just kind of see how we kind of score in that way.
Right. Glutenfreequiz.com will give you a score. Many people, what I suggest is that people print the gluten-free quiz out, if they score high, over 12, then they ought to take it to their doctor and ask, might I have celiac disease? Should I be tested for celiac disease? Because it gives everybody an objective basis for discussion. We did quite a lot of research to make sure the questions were precisely correct and to also to make it funny and fun so that it's both scientifically sound and easy to do. And it's one of those good karma things on the web that I did it because I thought there was a need. I don't make money from it, although there's some advertising on it. And it turns out that it really has helped now dozens of people get diagnosed. So it's pretty remarkable.
Well, I have to say, I did go to the gluten-free quiz, and I took the quiz, but then my computer froze up on me, so I didn't get to print it out. So I'm going to go back and do it again. I just kind of am curious because I've noticed after eating certain foods with gluten, I tend to have that kind of, like you said, fatigue and a bit of bloating. And I don't think I'm celiac, but I do think I have some issues with certain gluten, maybe. But anyway, it's a good thing to do for those of you who are kind of curious to see if you might be sensitive to gluten. It's a really good thing to do, and it's quick. It doesn't take very long. But, you know, I really want to talk about caregivers because that is, you know, why one of the reasons why I'm doing this show is to help the caregivers and help our HD people, HDers I call them. And what can we do about nutrition when we're in a stressful environment? How can we kind of manage that? What's your best advice there?
Well, I divide stress management into three categories: prepare, reframe, and control. Preparing for stress is much more effective than reframing or controlling. So the kinds of things that people ought to be able to do, ought to learn to do, to prepare for stress are ones that anticipate something going out of control. Mm-hmm. And there's a long list, and I cover some of them in the DVD through PBS. Mm-hmm. But maybe the most important one is to show, maybe there are two most important ones. The first is kind of is what I call a gratitude list. This isn't a revolutionary concept, but I find it a very effective one. I don't claim authorship of it. Mm-hmm. If you make a list of 10 things for which you're grateful, and I'm not talking about a house, a car, something material, but I'm talking about an experience or a relationship, because those are the mm-hmm. things that last. Houses and cars go away, mm-hmm. Or can. Relationships also can go away, but you can work on them and they can come back, unlike working in a house, which can still go away. So I have a list of 10 things for which I'm grateful for, and I prop it up in front of where I usually eat breakfast, and I look at it every morning. Mm-hmm. I don't look at it necessarily intentionally. It's just there, and mm-hmm. it catches my eye. But I think it's a good idea for people to look at it intentionally because it reminds you that there are a lot of good things in the world and that you're related to them. Mm-hmm. So a gratitude list as a preparation of one of 12 things that I actually identified to help prepare for stress is a really good one. And the second thing is something physical that is outside of your normal home environment. And by home environment, I don't necessarily mean the physical house. I just mean the place where you spend the most time. Mm-hmm. So, and yoga, even though it's poo-pooed in some circles, I think can really be life-changing because you understand your body and its capabilities quite differently. And some of the DVDs that are available for yoga are very good. And, of course, you can stream some yoga lessons on the web for free. So
good to know.
If you can spend 5 minutes, even 5 minutes, doing yoga, practicing specific poses, you find that you are more in control of other response processes. Mm-hmm. And I think it's one of the best ways to prepare for stress. The other two ways that I devise stress, reframing stress, I gave you one before.
Mm-hmm.
Pause, then respond, don't react. That's the ability to find a silver lining in anything that's traumatic or mm-hmm. seems traumatic. This is the A plus B equals C principle, A being the action, B being your beliefs about the action, and C being the consequences. A lot of people go straight from A to C.
Yeah.
But A doesn't go to C unless you add your beliefs.
Okay, so say those again now.
This is the A plus B equals C principle. A is the action, B are your beliefs, and C is the consequence.
Okay.
A lot of people go straight from A to C, the action, my house is being foreclosed on.
Ah, okay.
C, the consequence, it's the worst thing that's ever happened. Why does this always happen to me? It's going to be terrible. I'm going to lose everything now.
Yeah.
But those are actually beliefs.
Right.
You could work really hard and say, well, is there some silver lining? Is there something good about this? Can I find anything inside of it where, A, this might not happen, B, if it does happen, we'll have more freedom.
And that's really hard for us to do in the HD world because, you know, we're kind of living one day at a time. But I always tell my son, every day I try to tell him, we have to find one good thing to be happy about, to be thankful for. Even if it's just one thing, yes, it's good to find more things, but sometimes you're living in such a, you know, I don't know how you would describe it, but one minute at a time, you're just basically surviving one minute at a time. But, you know, it can be overwhelming to
It certainly can be overwhelming, absolutely.
Yeah.
And, you know, what you've talked about or alluded to, Melissa, is that you cannot, you have to take care of yourself, not just, it's in no way selfish, but it's to avoid burning out. It's to avoid institutionalization, often for those who are highly impaired. If you don't go outside the home and have experiences that are for your own development and for your own release, you will not be as effective. And the effectivity, you know, or effectiveness is really what part of the goal. So living one minute at a time is a really high stress way to go.
Mm-hmm.
It's, then you do really need control mechanisms. You need the 4-7-8 belly breath that I teach for road rage or an insomnia. You need other ways of coping. You certainly need, and I don't know if you have, but anybody in your position ought to have secondary and tertiary caregivers who are not the primary one, but can be part of the picture when needed. And you can trade services with them. If you can't pay them, then you can cook for them, or you can do something else that has value for them that's within your skill set.
Creative ways to get that going, right?
Right. But living one minute to the next is a desperate feeling kind of approach. And it isn't a long-term or even very short-term sustainable approach.
Mm-hmm.
So preparing, reframing, and controlling is one way to begin to think about this so that it isn't every minute, it's maybe every day.
Mm-hmm.
And that actually is more controllable if it's,
right.
if you think about it as an everyday.
Right, right. Good advice. Wow.
Well,
I don't
envy you your task, but I admire you, and I think what you're doing is powerful.
One of hundreds of thousands of people that are going through this, and you know, caregivers are notorious for you know, helping other people and not themselves. So, you know, my main goal for this show is to kind of urge myself to listen to your advice and offer this advice to all of our caregivers out there listening and all of our HDers, because they too are many times in caregiving positions. So they may be caring for a child, or they may be caring for an adult, and they also may be HD. So, you know, this is quite a universal bit of advice that you're giving us, and we really appreciate you spending the time with us, and we are honored that you're willing to give us this advice. So,
well, I believe in what you're doing, and I think you're doing noble work, and you just have to know that you don't have to be perfect, that you can make mistakes and just pick yourself up and dust yourself off and go to the next issue. This is how you play the hand you're dealt, not what the hand is. And that's true about eating, by the way, as well. So, and genetics. So keep doing the powerful work you're doing. And thank you so much for letting me participate.
Yeah. Well, now one more question. I wanted to find out, you know, making food choices is kind of difficult sometimes, but and cost is an issue sometimes. So with that in mind, what are some kind of healthy, affordable options for healthy eating, not processed foods?
I think that the most powerful tool for healthy eating is a chef's knife. I think if you take a cooking class or find a cookbook that works for you, my Cooking the Real Age Way cookbook we wrote as a basic healthy cookbook, and it's been reviewed in a number of places as you know, just that. But there are many other good cookbooks. I love Mark Bittman's work. I think Deborah Madison is an inspired cook. Rick Bayless is a hero of mine, and his recipes are easy in his books. And I worked in that kitchen, full disclosure, for 4 years. So,
wow.
Find a good cookbook. Take a good cooking class at a local community college or an adult education or from a local cooking school. And to learn to cook even a little, that's the first step in lowering your costs and getting better food. And does it take more time? Yes, it does. And will that kill it for some people? Yes, it may. So if it does kill it for you and you don't want to cook more or you can't cook more because you don't have the time, then the second big suggestion would become a good assembler. Assembly food is easier than cooked food, but it doesn't mean buying from the deli or buying from the supermarket prepared section. It might mean buying from the salad bar. That's more expensive, but it's already prepped. It does mean buying more frozen and canned goods. And the quality of many frozen and canned goods is really pretty high for nutritionally. In many of my Chef MD recipes, I use canned beans, rinsed from BPA-free cans, usually Eden Foods. But it doesn't have to be BPA-free cans if you can't find them or it's not in your budget. More BPA actually comes from grocery receipts and gas station receipts. BPA. BPA is bisphenol A, which is a toxic chemical that probably is a neurotoxin that is on was in plastic baby bottles and now no longer in plastic baby bottles. Right.
Yeah.
And it's been outlawed in Canada and is on its way to being outlawed here. And it's in the lining of many food cans. But Eden Foods and a number of other producers are now producing cans without BPA. And they're so you don't have to worry about it. But as I just said, there's more BPA on a grocery receipt or a gas station receipt than there is on inside a can. So, I think canned beans and canned salmon, all of which is wild salmon, otherwise $30 a pound fresh, $2 a can in CVS or Rite Aid. Wild salmon is pretty good, and it can be used just as tuna fish, and is better than tuna fish in my view for most people, both because it's omega-3 fatty acids and because it doesn't have the mercury that large tuna may have. And learn to grocery shop from a list. I think that's the most important thing, that when you do buy food and you assemble food, if you have a list, you're less likely to make impulse purchases that are high calorie and also often high dollar.
Right. Wow. Well, this was definitely a jam-packed episode, and I thank you so much for all of your information, for teaching us about stress management. That's a big one for us and for all of our caregivers and HDRs. And is there anything else that you can think of that you'd like to add that we haven't covered today to kind of give us a last little boost of information?
I think it's mostly that one, you really have more control than you think. Often life feels out of control, but you can really look and feel better starting today if you are successful from day one. And that's what my books and my and TV shows try to do. And I try to make you successful from day one so that you don't have to wait to experience good health. You don't have to wait to start to get on the journey. You can go and do something right now that's life-changing because you have more control than you think.
That is wonderful. Thank you so much. And I think if you don't have anything more, this concludes our show today with Dr. John LaPuma. And you can find Dr. LaPuma at www.drjohnlapuma.com and on Facebook, Dr. John LaPuma. My email is helpforhd@yahoo.com. Of course, please click follow on the site for email reminders of upcoming episodes. And John, people can reach you through your website. They can email you through your website. Is that correct?
Yes, they can.
Okay.
I do read all the email on the website, and either I'll get back to you or Barbara or Thomas will.
Wonderful. And you have a really great Facebook page and some really good information on there. I think your link to your books on Amazon.com are there as well, are they?
They are. Thanks so much for sharing
yes,
that.
And don't forget to go to shoppbs.org and look for Dr. LaPuma's DVDs. And will you be announcing when they're available, maybe on Facebook?
I'm going to be watching with the rest of us because they ought to be available yet. I'm not sure whether or not. But otherwise, your local PBS station will have them.
Great. And don't forget to check with your local listings, your PBS listings, for Dr. LaPuma. The show is called Eat and Cook Healthy with Dr. John LaPuma. That's going to be aired in June, right?
That's right, first weekend, and actually for a couple of weeks during June.
Well, awesome show. Thank you so much, and we'll be in touch soon, I hope. And I hope you do Blog Talk Radio show. That'd be great.
Well, thanks for the encouragement. We'll look into it.
Okay, super. Thanks again. Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye. Thanks
Bye-bye.
Again.